You're immediately giving a subliminal lift that the audience will feel, but they won't realize that it's happening. As someone that writes music or produces music, you have to work really hard to disengage the part of your brain that is always just taking apart what you listen to. I think there's a difference between perceiving in an intellectual sense and being able to go, oh, that's 89 BPM and that's 92 BPM versus the way we feel music.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, The Queen, Jungle, Earth, Wind & Fire, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, The 1975, Madness, Oasis, The Zootons, The Prodigy and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with the Beatles, Beyonce, Elvis and David Bowie. Today we are joined by drummer of the Temper Trap, Toby Dundas, where we'll be discussing what it's like supporting Rolling Stones and Coldplay, what it's like playing to 100,000 people at the MCG, and how Toby stays on top of evolving production techniques, and we'll find out if it's true the band once walked on stage at an arena show only for the guitar amp to die during their walk on music. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Toby the Temper Trap. Thanks for joining us today, Toby. How's it going?
Hey, Chris. Yeah, going very well. Great to be here.
Good, good, good. Now, you are in a very beautiful studio. Tell us about this studio. It's your studio. I believe you built this studio and it's in your, not only doing your own music in there, but you're also working with young artists. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We kind of had the chance to build a studio in London for the last Temper Trap record, which meant we were able to collect a bunch of really nice gear. And so when I moved back to Australia at the end of 2017, I kind of always wanted to find a space here. And I'm in a place called Fallback Studios and there's eight other rooms here and yeah, really good vibes and I've been able to set everything up just right and nice little community vibe here and great to be able to get the chance to work with a bunch of young emerging artists now.
And how do you choose which artists you work with?
A lot of things come in through like publishing, like there's so much co-writing that's become such a kind of bedrock of young artists these days, like all the publishers farming around to anyone that's got a studio pretty much. So they bring lots of cool stuff in. And then, yeah, just listening to some things on SoundCloud and seeing some local bands and reaching out to people as well.
And what are you learning from working with new emerging artists in a producer role that you might not have experienced with your own band?
It's a definitely very different dynamic, which is really good. You know, Temper Trap's been going since like 2004 and gradually as you build a box around yourself that can be hard to break out of and you get into the way you do things doesn't always change. And I think working with other artists, it's just really interesting seeing their perspective on writing, but also from my perspective, like I can go in really freely and this doesn't suit the band or this doesn't feel right for, this is too pop or all those kind of things. Like it's just very free and open and you can go on that journey when you first meet the artist and start that creative process and find like where things are going, because often the artists are at a stage where they're still discovering their sound as well. It's really fun to be in that, just always on the cusp of discovering something new in a way, which isn't always possible in a something that's been going on for a longer time.
And if I was an artist walking into your studio and I had a bit of the old red light syndrome and just maybe felt a bit intimidated working with someone like yourself, for instance, how would you relax that person? Do you have a particular method to get the best out of that performance? Because we're all great at performing in our own bedrooms, right? And the moment we go into a kind of a new setting, it can tighten us up. What do you do to keep things loose?
I think that's definitely true. Like, I think I just try and keep things really like low key and relaxed and be encouraging of firstly like the creative process, because it can be a really weird thing. It's like a bit speed dating, like you've never met someone and suddenly you're in a room together and they're bearing like often like quite personal things in, because that's what songs are about, the good ones. And so yeah, you very quickly jump up a couple of levels of how much you know about each other. And just, I think that's just important to make people feel relaxed and comfortable to be able to share that stuff initially. And often, I don't know, I try and spend quite a while just like talking with people and listening to what they have to say about like where they're coming from as a writer and an artist and what the song ideas that they might have and what they're about. And so that by the time you sort of are jumping into, okay, let's record some ideas, you've at least built like some familiarity and a level of trust that they feel really relaxed to kind of get themselves right into the moment that's going to capture the best performance.
And I'll ask the same question again, but from you being on the receiving end of that, if you look through your career, what's particularly worked for you when you've walked into kind of maybe, I know you've worked with some obviously great producers, like people worked Arctic Monkeys, Xavier and stuff like that. So when you've walked into studios when you were a bit younger and you felt a bit like that, what helped relax you?
Yeah, I mean, working with Jim Abbas, like Jim was particularly intense, and that was our first experience of being in a big studio, like making our first record here in Melbourne, and Jim had flown out and we had a relatively short space of time. So he's a really hard taskmaster. So I'm not sure he did make us feel relaxed, but wow. I found personally, like that's been like one of my favorite experiences in terms of working with a producer. Like I think he really pushed us and got the best out of us in a way that other people that are maybe more had a more relaxed vibe like didn't necessarily do.
How did he push you? Was it around particular techniques, or was it technical things with your instruments? Was it driving you to think deeper about what the lyrics might be about? What way did he push you?
Yeah, initially a good example is I think he's really into kind of creating tempo, really fine tempo maps. So he'd just get us to play the song over. And I think we'd say Love Lost. I remember having to play it at least 30 times and he'd just be like sitting at the back of the room with a metronome, just sort of like tapping out where we were naturally like speeding up, slowing down, where that sort of like the breathing in the song was like happening naturally, and then designing like a tempo map so that we could play to, we'd be playing to a click when we actually recorded, but it feels like just a band playing live. And that's definitely one of the tricks like that I've taken through into other productions. I think in a lot of sort of more modern pop that can be very regimented and feel quite loopy and it's all one tempo, like I always advise people to spend some time just like thinking about that and finding some natural sort of like places where the song can breathe. And if you're like, fuck, why isn't this chorus like hitting the way I want it to? And if you bump it up half a BPM or a BPM, you're immediately giving a subliminal lift that like the audience will feel, but they won't realize that it's happening. I think there's a difference between perceiving in an intellectual sense and being able to go, oh, that's 89 BPM and that's 92 BPM versus the way we feel music. And that's always like a really interesting dichotomy between like listening or hearing music versus feeling it. And definitely something that you, as someone that writes music or produces music, you have to work really hard to like disengage the part of your brain that is always just like taking apart what you listen to. Jim would have maps like you'd be going down 0.25 for like the little holds afterwards, and they were so designed. It was to see the effort that he put into getting them right and the effort we had to put into playing the songs a million times in order to happen. But yeah, he was just like, he's just an intense guy. And so everything was like always just like, he doesn't let you get away with anything. If it's not a performance that's up to scratch, you just do it again and over again. And it was really worth it. And like, that's not going to work for everyone, but for us in that moment, and like some of the other guys in the band might look back on it with like less fond memories. But yeah, I felt like it was worth the sort of the short-term pain for the long-term gain. It was good. It was a good boot camp for playing a good version of the song.
Do you know, when you were describing him, sounds a bit military, right? And then you've just used the word like boot camp, which is interesting. And I'm also just thinking what a great idea the tempo maps are, because I can think of drummers who gave up playing the drums because going into a studio, just like trying to play exactly to a click, it just wasn't for them. And that kind of natural flow, you just think, ugh. So that's great that's available to do now. And do you use those tempo maps live?
Yeah, we do use the tempo maps. Yeah, with the sort of playback stuff, it's all stems from the album versions. So yeah, it does follow the tempo maps that we ended up using for the final versions. It's great because it does the same thing it does in the record. It just gives the songs a chance to find those sort of like almost subliminal lifts that you get by going up a BPM in the chorus or coming down half a BPM into the verse.
What I want to talk to you also about is the fact that over the last few years, obviously you're doing stuff in the studio, but you've become a dad as well. And parenting and the music industry, they're not loggerheads with each other. It's quite a difficult thing to be. But, you know, I became parent 18, 19 months ago, and I don't do half the stuff I did do right beforehand. Is that the same in regards to your world? If you were writing, recording 30 songs, are you now writing, recording 15 to 20 songs because of the time and stuff like that? How are you finding the relationship between those two huge roles in your life?
Yeah, it's a constant kind of learning process. Our son, Wynn, was born. He was like 6 months old when the sort of all the lockdowns happened, the pandemic lockdown started happening here. So in that sense, like there wasn't really like any loggerheads because the band was just like taking a break because we couldn't really do anything. But yeah, even just like we're about to go on tour starting next week. And like even next week, I was like, oh guys, I can't get to a rehearsal until 6 o'clock at night because I can't find anyone to look after Wynn and my wife's at work that day. So yeah, the logistics of just juggling that sort of like simple stuff. Yeah, something we're going to have to get used to and figure out. And obviously my studio days before, it's like you might come in at 2 or 3 and you might go home at 2 or 3. And now it's like I'm like here between 9:30 and 10 and I try and go home at 4:30. So I'm home to like help with dinner and do baths and put Wynn to bed as much as possible. So yeah, it's a very, very different lifestyle. I'm definitely not going to see as many gigs as I used to either.
And how do you feel at the prospect of touring? That must be so difficult. And like your partner as well, that's going to be really difficult on your partner.
Yes, yeah, it will be difficult on her. She's actually just come back. She was away for her work for 10 days in Paris and London. So I've just done 10 days on my own with Wynn. So I've got those brownie points in the bank. So this kind of tour we're doing with Kings of Leon coming up, I think I'm all right for that. And it's only 3 weeks and it's just Australia and New Zealand. So we're not away for that whole time. We'll be back in Melbourne every 4 days or something like that. But yeah, it'll be interesting. Like next year, if we release some more music and we do some more significant touring, then yeah, there will be times when I could be away for a month or something like that. And that's going to be tough for Pip and Wynn, and it'll be tough for me as well. I know Johnny, who's the bass player in the band, has his two kids, Stella and Jesse. Stella's just turned 11. So Johnny's done a lot of that where we'd be away for 6-7 weeks on tour because it was like right when we were really busy, and his wife Brittany was home on her own with two kids. Yeah, it's a tough gig particularly for the people that have to stay home and hold down the fort.
And it's something that we don't see, right? So the music industry doesn't really talk about it so much. It's not really geared for parents in some ways who have to tour, particularly parents of young kids. And I don't know what we can do about it, but it's an interesting kind of conversation to have. Is there anything that your bandmates have advised you, or if there's anything that you would advise a young musician who's on the cusp of doing something in the music industry and wants to have kids or has just had kids? Like, what are the workarounds? What are the things that you would advise people to do in that situation so that they could still do what they want to achieve, both as a parent and as a musician?
I think in that case, like you're going to be making sacrifices on both sides. I don't think there is a perfect world where you can get everything that you want out of parenting and everything you want out of your sort of music career. So you've just got to find a way to make it work. And if that's like doing shorter tours or taking young kids on the road, it's obviously like a lot more expensive and things like that, but people do it. And yeah, it's just a matter of finding out what works best for you and how you can get the most out of each of those two paths, because they're a bit of a water and oil situation and they don't naturally mix together. So you got to work hard to make it happen, I imagine.
That's really beautifully put, actually. Thank you for sharing that. And you just mentioned you're going on a support tour with Kings of Leon. How does the psychology change when you know you're going on tour to support another artist? Do you feel more relaxed? Does it feel like a normal gig? Does it feel like an opportunity? Do you think, okay, we'll try out some new stuff? Like, how does it differ to playing your own gig that you're headlining?
I think it's like more relaxing, actually. Like some of the pressure of carrying a show and also people paying money to see you. When it's your headline show, that's a very different vibe when you're there as the support band. So it feels more like an opportunity to play in front of people who may not have heard of you at all. And it's like a chance to win new fans. And you've got a shorter time slot. So you might have a 45-minute set instead of a 90-minute set. So it's a bit cruisier. You don't have to learn so many songs or remember so many songs from the old days. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, particularly as we haven't done any shows for heading towards 3 years. So this feels like a sort of easy way to just ease back into it and get our tour legs going again before we potentially do some stuff on our own next year. Part of that tour, they're playing their Melbourne shows at the Sydney Meyer Music Bowl, which is a really iconic venue here in Melbourne. I saw one of my first concerts there, Pearl Jam concert, back in, what year would that have been? Like maybe 95. And yeah, so really excited to finally get to play there.
Yeah, it sounds like an exciting a few gigs you've got coming
up. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome number one chart toppers and multi-ARIA award-winning band, The Temper Trap.
The MCG as well, which I think was like the halftime show at the AFL final?
Yes.
Was that a bit of a surreal experience playing that? And what's it like, you know, tell us about what your kind of highlights were of that day and standing in front, you know, in a bowl of, I've been there myself, like 100,000 people. That's an incredible experience, a unique experience.
Yes, yeah, it is a crazy experience. We've actually had the chance to do it twice now. We just did it recently, like a couple of weeks ago, which was, that was phenomenal. Great, got to play with a bunch of fantastic artists. And yeah, that one was really strange because that was literally like, we hadn't done any shows for, like I said, years. It was like getting wheeled out of the deep freeze straight onto the stage in the middle of the MCG in front of 100,000 people. It's so big that it almost blurs out, and you just like focus on what's happening in the sort of small space around you playing music. But yeah, as you're walking back off, it becomes really real what just happened and just how many people are kind of in there. And for myself, like, I'm a big AFL football fan and grew up as a kid wanting to be a footy player, but never being any good at it. So to get the chance to be out there in the middle of the field doing something that I love, like music, is, yeah, pretty good second best to being out there kicking the footy. This time around, the AFL organised, I don't know if you're seeing that, organised grand final match balls with all the artist names. Temper Trap, G Flip, Robbie Williams was there, Nairi and Bujara played with us, and Goanna, who are iconic Australian band as well. So yeah, it was really good to be a part of something like that.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that. I'll let you put that back. Oh, there we go. I want to talk about the fact that you met Dougie in a clothing store. And I always wonder, if Dougie hadn't got that job, or if you hadn't got that job, What do you think the next kind of 15 years of your life would have looked like? Do you think you would have been sat in the same place as you are now? Do you think that you'd be doing a completely different career? Do you think you'd be an AFL player? What do you think would have happened if you hadn't, one of you hadn't got that job?
I mean, I was playing in some bands and stuff when I first met Dougie. So yeah, I don't think those bands would still have been going. I think that would have fizzled out pretty quickly, but certainly I was like interning and stuff at a recording studio here in Melbourne. And basically even when the bands were going, I wasn't expecting them to be a career as such, like to have the momentum to keep going. I was just like, oh, I just want to work in a studio and be an engineer. So I think if I hadn't met Dougie, yeah, potentially like I'd still be doing something similar in terms of what I'm doing now with working with other artists. But yeah, it's just more on the technical side than the creative side, I guess.
Yeah, it's such an interesting kind of concept to think about.
I mean, I don't know if this is a tall poppy thing, but we'd never necessarily felt like we fit in what was happening in Australian music in the sort of mid-2000s. Johnny was the biggest dreamer of all. He felt like probably from the second rehearsal or whatever that he was at, that something like what happened could happen. It just wasn't something that felt that like things like that happened. And I was happy just like trying to write songs, playing shows, having fun. The sort of really popular kind of bands at that felt like they was coming up around us or a few years before. It was like the Presets and Cut Copy, Midnight Juggernauts, and all like amazing bands, fantastic live bands, but definitely with a more electronic bent than what we had, and kind of Modular Records and Bang Gang DJs and all that kind of stuff. Like that sort of like dancier element was like very cool, and we weren't very cool, like we weren't part of that. So maybe that's something that's made us look outward and look for somewhere where we felt like we fit in better. Something like Triple J versus something like BBC Introducing, or I guess like Radio 1 as well. Certainly like getting a song on Radio 1 totally just opened up the entire sort of like UK in one go. To us when we moved over there, we had a little level of recognition here, and Triple J had obviously played songs from the EP and played, I guess at that stage, Sweet Disposition sort of came out here initially, like the end of 2008, and it got a bit lost, I guess. But when we moved over to the UK and Sweet Disposition got its UK release, which is, I don't know, maybe it was like 6 months later or something, it certainly was the thing that opened up all of the UK and all the festivals, and then obviously like Europe and everything went from that in that sort of world. I think the mold of Triple J has changed so much from when we were coming through. I guess Australia's different because there's certainly something comforting about, you know, like being close to home and the support networks you have. But we always felt as a band, we wanted to like to go to the UK and like try and make a go over there. So that was always like on the cards. And we got lucky that after we first went over there and did I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically like a sort of London version of Big Sound here or Great Escape. And yeah, the guy that ended up signing us in the UK, Corder Marshall, just happened to see us. So Corder is Infectious Records. He'd come from a long career at Warner and things like that, and he retired. He tells a story. His plan was to go sailing for a year, but his daughter Summer, who we ended up working with Emma Banks. She was an agent with Emma and has gone on to really great things. But yeah, she, I think, told Corder to come down and check out a bunch of these bands. We played at a venue called The Borderline, which is like in Soho, little sort of basement joint. And yeah, that Corder saw something in us, and between him and Michael Gidinski, because they had worked together on things in the past, coincidentally, they really helped us make that landing in the UK, which we would have done anyway, but they like made it a lot smoother and easier. And you're still starting from scratch. Like we'd be playing to 20 people in London, we'd be getting in a van and like doing the toilet tour, as they call it, and playing gigs in Coventry and going up to Glasgow and playing to 50 people and just like putting in those hard yards that any band has to do. But yeah, certainly when Radio 1 decided to take a chance on Sweet Disposition and put it on their like main playlist or whatever they call it, that was a real game changer.
One thing I wanted to explore with you is that we have a lot of young musicians or emerging artists who are having to juggle the fact that they have to have other jobs and the internal conflict with their values and that kind of thing. And this might be a difficult question. What do you think you learned from those early jobs that you had that at the time you probably thought were pointless and frivolous and just paying for bills and stuff like that, that actually, if it has seeped through to what you do today, did you learn anything from those early jobs that, even though they seemed pointless at the time in some ways, actually helped you in your career?
Yeah, maybe my paper round when I was 14, getting up at 5 a.m. to deliver papers, taught me a good work ethic. But General Pants, the clothing shop, I don't know if that necessarily, I think Dougie and I would both say that as much as there was a lot of fun working there and there's a really good group of people that work there, and actually strangely, like, quite a lot of like people have gone on to do really interesting kind of creative things that sort of all worked there, but I think the thing we'd say mostly about working at General Pants is that it really made us want the band to be good.
That was the motivator. That was the motivator.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's really noticeable listening to your stuff, and I think that really stands out new bands when they come through, is their use of harmonies. And some of the harmonies that you guys do are just so beautiful. And I think it just adds such a layer of sophistication when you see a new emerging band come through, like you were 13, 14 years ago, and you're using those harmonies. Talk about your use of harmony as a backing vocalist. And was there anyone who you particularly admired when they did that? Because you've got so many lovely harmonies that you do.
Yeah, look, I'm probably the like least proficient singer in the band. My brother is like an opera singer with Opera Australia. So he snagged all the vocal genes in our family. Yeah. But Dougie obviously has a phenomenal voice and a really amazing and just innate sense of harmony and melody. So a lot of that's him. And then Lorenzo, who used to be in the band, and Joseph, who still is, yeah, both like nice backing vocalists who can sit in and find those spots. But I think like most of the credit for the sort of like creating those parts, like coming up with the harmonies, is definitely Dougie.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. What does it feel? I know that you reunited with the old guitarist Lorenzo at the Conditions 10th anniversary show at the Forum. How did that go down, and how was that kind of reuniting, that dynamic? And did that feel natural? Did it feel awkward? How was it then? I think it was in 2019.
Yeah, it was pretty good, to be honest. Like, I mean, Lorenzo and I were mates from like year 8 in high school. So we've been friends since we were 14. So even when he left the band, he and I like remained really close. Our wives are best friends as well. So I see him all the time, and he's still really close with the other guys as well. So in a way, it felt quite natural for him to come back. Some of the sort of idiosyncrasies of a long-term relationship, which a band is, like, definitely reared their heads by at the end of that tour, because we had a run of maybe 5 or 6 shows. I think the Forum might have been the first one, so we surprised everyone. I think we came out and did 1 or 2 songs, and like Loz snuck out to be a sort of special unannounced special guest. And so yeah, so it was great. Like, I think it was a really nice way of like honoring his contribution to the band in the early days. And yeah, just looking back to that, as you do at these sort of anniversary shows, but also I guess now us looking forward as well.
And you've been a pivotal part of the band for its entire existence. And I wonder, what do you think that is down to? Is that down to a particular personality you have that's meant that you're maybe a bit more placid and you avoid conflict? Or is it a case that you navigate conflict particularly well because you use a particular kind of approach to it? What do you think, and I'm asking this question from the perspective of, there are so many bands that split up sadly because of internal conflict, and that beautiful music is never heard. And so I'm just trying to think, what are ways in which that have worked for you to be able to not leave a band, basically stay in a band and work with your friends since you've known them, since being a young man through to today?
Yeah, it is a really interesting kind of relationship, the band relationship. And I never, as a kid, your favorite band breaks up and you're like, why do bands break up? Your life is so cool. You just like roam around the world, like making music and playing amazing shows and getting to do whatever you want. I'm like, why would you stop doing that? But once you're in a band and you are thrown into that like very heavy touring lifestyle, you do see all the sort of like pressure points that would get to people. And I think the thing that sort of kept us together was that we got along as mates in the first place. And because we had that like early foundation of like being Dougie and Johnny knew each other for years before the band. And then obviously Dougie and I became friends working together. Lorenzo and I had been friends forever, as I mentioned. And then Joseph, who came on initially as our sort of touring member when we finished recording Conditions, we're like, we need an extra set of hands to like play these songs. And Joseph had worked with us at General Pants as well for probably like 3 years or something by that stage. So we all just wasn't, no one was like a hired musician that we found on an ad and kind of just brought them in, and the personalities didn't mix. I think our sort of like our mixture of personalities was complementary enough that you can deal with the inevitable bad stuff. Obviously with Lorenzo, it came to a point for him that he was getting married and having a kid. And for him, I guess like we were talking about before, it was like a juggle between do I want to be home with my family versus being out on the road. And so that was a decision he made, but obviously with no bad blood, given that we're all still friends and we sort of brought him back for those anniversary shows.
I mean, on longer tours when you're living in each other's pockets, it must just, whoever it is, no matter how much you love the person, it's going to eventually break and be difficult for you. What do you do in situations like that to take the sting out of things? What's advice, having gone through that and probably going through that again soon, what would you do differently this time that you might not have done when you were a bit younger to make sure things remain harmonious?
Yeah, yeah. It's very hectic. I don't know, you think about you're living in a bus together, like driving around America for months at a time, and it's all close quarters, and there's the stress of having to perform wanting to perform a really great show every night, even though sometimes you like you don't have the energy, or you might be hungover, or people are sick, all those kind of things that happen. There's the stress of and pressure of wanting singles to do well and all that kind of stuff. So there is always that stuff floating around. I don't know. I think back like that there's a really good music documentary called Dig that's about the Brian Jonestown massacre and the Dandy Warhols. Worth a watch if any of the listeners haven't checked that one out. But I remember they're talking about, because obviously the Brian Jonestown massacre imploded and the Dandy Warhols became one of the biggest bands in the world at the time. And I think the guitarist says in it something like, he gets asked the question, like, how did you guys like manage to stay together? What was your secret? And he says something along the lines of, the way we look at things is if it's good, then it's fun. And if it's bad, then it's funny. And you've just got to be able to like not take yourself too seriously and realize that you're not always going to get along with people. And if you can put your ego aside, even if it feels trodden on at certain times, at the end of the day, it's like you're part of something and you're bringing yourself to that. And it works best when everyone's sort of playing their role in a sort of a team sort of way. So yeah, I think something like that, where you've just got to be able to laugh at things that are hard and not take yourself too seriously. I think Australians naturally have that in them, where we're not afraid to take the piss out of ourselves. So that's a definitely a good diffuser of tense situations.
So we've been joined by Thea, who's going on stage. Thea, tell us about the gig you're playing in a moment. And then you've got a couple of questions for Toby. Hey, Thea.
Hey,
Thea.
How are you?
Good, how are you? Really?
Yeah, I'm really good. How's it going?
Good, good.
I can see you're at the Gasso.
I am at the Gasso, green room and all.
Yes. Nice.
Yeah, I'm at the Gasso. I'm doing a residency this month, which is super exciting. So every Wednesday night of October, I'm here. Tonight's the solo week. So yeah, a little bit angsty about that. Can't hide behind the band, but it should be fun. So we've just got amazing support streaming Soda on at the moment. And yeah, we'll be here for the next two Wednesdays as well. Yeah, so that's tonight. And I certainly do have a few questions for Toby. And just wanted to say thank you for being part of some of the soundtrack to my teenage and younger years as well. I've got two sisters that I can vividly remember when none of us had our own devices, all of us hovering around the family computer, and my oldest sister being like, Dad, there's this new song called Sirens, and I know you don't like any of my music, but I know you're gonna like this. Like, you just
will. Wow. That's cool. That's very early doors too. I haven't had anyone reference Sirens for a long time. Yeah. Excellent.
And he was like the music door for us three, so it was special. But yeah, when I was thinking about questions for you, that's actually a special moment.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So I suppose questions-wise, one thing that I wanted to ask you about, I feel like I frequently get told that I just need to focus on making music I love and cuts and always and kind of that is that that's the first and foremost thing that you need to consider is just making sure that you're doing stuff you love. But I always find that a really confusing statement because I think as creatives, most of us have a lot of, and humans have a lot of self-doubt just inherently, and figuring out whether if your self-doubt getting in the way or you actually don't like what you're doing is a really hard thing, I find. And how do you go about knowing whether it's something that you like? And I guess because we have to self-judge so much and it's hard to actually acknowledge that you like something that you are doing, how do you go about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really tricky thing to navigate as an artist. And certainly, like, when you're starting out, there are so many voices sitting on your shoulders and questioning everything that you do. I don't know, perhaps like, if I'm thinking back to when we were starting, like, we would play live so much that we were always, like, road testing the material in a way. And that sort of, there's nothing like that immediate feedback that you do get from a live audience to know that you're on the right path. Obviously, like you're saying, it's the most important thing in anything that you're making is that you love it first and foremost, because I certainly know, like, the songs we've written where we were like didn't put our feet down at the right time and it goes too far and then you can't take it back. So that's something you definitely got to hold really close and make sure you stand up for yourself in all those situations. But certainly in terms of like silencing the voices, I think that sort of feedback from a live audience is really great because it's real. Like, they're not going to pretend to like your song. And so, that's something that you can trust. Whereas you can't always trust, like, your close, can't always trust your own brain, that's for sure. And then you can't always trust, like, the people in your immediate circle because, you know, they're going to, like, potentially just sugarcoat things or whatever.
100%. They go one way or the other. They either sugarcoat it or know you so well that they pick up your flaws as easily as you do.
That's true. That's very true. I think certainly, like, with a lot of artists I was working with in the past couple of years in all the lockdowns in Melbourne, like, just didn't necessarily have that because no one was able to play gigs. So I think it's great that the sort of live music scene getting back going now, because there is that chance to play a lot of shows and just try all your songs out. Like, it's great. The Gasso residencies are great. They're getting to play 4 shows in a month. Such a great opportunity to, like, test out material, I think.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, that's super good advice. I think you're very right. No one can hide in that live clearing. You can tell if someone's vibing it or not.
Make that really
hide that. That's hard of it. Yeah, no, awesome. Thank you. The other thing I wanted to ask was, you guys have achieved so much, and I think a lot of us to even get to an inch of that would be a dream come true. But I think the nature of life is often that we don't realize or we don't acknowledge our milestones, and we're always searching for that next thing, regardless of where you are in your career. It's really hard. I find it really hard to see how far you've come or what. And I guess I'm interested to know how you personally, and then as a band, I guess, have managed to, if you have managed to kind of find those moments where you can really look back on how far you've come and be proud of that in a world that's so what's next focused.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's certainly really tough. Like, we do, like, live in the moment, and when things are, like, on a roll and really busy, there's always something new that's happening. So it's always what's next. I guess, like, for us, the last few years where we haven't actively been trying to do the band has been a sort of good chance of just taking some reflective time.
Yeah.
I've become a parent in that time as well, and that certainly, like, changes your sort of relationship with things, of whether it's like, my son Wynn really loves, like, singing, having songs sung to him, and try out a few of the band songs, and it's really funny. He doesn't like any of them so far.
Artists say that their kids do not like their own stuff. It's so interesting.
Yeah. Maybe they somehow know what's going on. But yeah, the other thing, we got to do, like, a 10th anniversary, like, conditions thing, like, end of 2019, which I was talking with Chris about before, and brought back our old guitarist, and just going back to playing some of those songs that you haven't played, for some of the songs off that album we wouldn't have played, like, since it came out. So that was a bit of a nostalgia moment, and certainly a good opportunity to look back and reconnect with some of the people from around that time and think about what we did. But yeah, I think Like, if you can be conscious of that, as you obviously are as a new artist, bringing up a question like that, just, yeah, try and remember, just remember all the little moments, because, yeah, I definitely think I've, people say stuff and they're like, "Wow, really, we did that?" And you've forgotten. So I think it's really good to, maybe because we didn't have social media back then either, so there's no, like, I don't have Instagram photos of different stuff. It's just, I've just got to rely on my old brain.
Yeah, so true. I probably do have to run.
Oh, all good. You've got to play your show. Got to keep those people happy, right?
But honestly, so yeah, I'm so grateful to be able to chat for even a very brief moment. Yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
Thank you to all of you for having me here. Yeah, hopefully catch you all around in a less rush scenario sometime soon.
Yeah, go fantastic. Well, thanks for the questions. Have a great show.
No, thank you so much. Thank you. And thanks, Chris and Sebastian, for having me.
Cheers, Thea. Play well. Go well.
Thanks so much. See ya.
Great questions. Well done.
Thanks. Cheers. Bye.
So Thea Fitzgerald is a Melbourne-based musician, singer-songwriter and budding producer, influenced by the likes of Paul Kelly, The Pretenders, Stevie Wonder and Freddie Mercury. Thea has been touring America and Europe as well, and has been doing songwriting camps in London as well. And she has a really interesting kind of approach to songwriting. It sounded really, really original, and I'm kind of very excited by it. And recently released a single called Woman, which you can find on Spotify and other outlets as well. And more tracks are coming next year. Nice. That was great. Thank you. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, that was really nice.
Okay. So you were talking previously about being on tour buses and traveling across America, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the shows you did, like the likes of David Letterman shows and that kind of thing, that must be such a high pressure 3 or 4 minutes in your kind of professional life, right? It's interesting how, like, go to work and stuff, but like very, on few occasions would like that high pressure be so squeezed into like 4 minute segment, right? What would you advise a young musician such as Thea if they got into that position to thrive in that situation? So they're not going, I just want to get this out of the way, or you know, they're absolutely, everything's in place. So they can really smash that and not be overthinking it, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's a really hard thing. And even for me, I'm not like a naturally stand in the spotlight kind of person. Like, maybe I think that's why I'm a drummer. I'm happy to be up the back in the shadows as much as possible. But for the people that like do struggle, who are the sort of the artist up the front, the singer in the spotlight, and who do struggle with that, I don't know that I'm the best person to ask. I think that's something that's really hard, because not everyone has that sort of personality that thrives on that sort of energy. And the ones that do, it's almost like a drug to them. They have to be up there, and they find it harder to be out of that space. But I don't know, maybe you've just got to be really good at like blocking out the sort of the noise and focusing on what's happening right in front of you, and just getting past that. If I don't know, a lot of those things, like if you can get through the first sort of 30 seconds, that initial like wave of anxiety that comes from being put in a situation like that, then yeah, I don't know, maybe the euphoria takes over. That it's that weird mix of excitement and nerves that sort of seem to be two sides of the same coin. And I guess if you can push down the nerves and push up the excitement, then you can give a great performance.
Playing a lot of these songs many times over, how do you keep it fresh so you're not thinking, oh, I've got to play that bloody song again?
Yeah, the thing that does keep it fresh is actually the audience, because the audience is different every time, and you never really get sick of like that connection that you can make with an audience. And so they make every time you play it a new time of playing it. Certainly there is, I've been trying to learn a bunch of the songs for the Kings of Leon tour, and I've always got to try and find live videos, because the way you were playing them last time is completely different to the album version. Like particularly with the, I guess, with the drums, that there's so many like little intricate things that you might have like slightly changed that no one else would really pick up on. But yeah, I can't, if I listen back to the album version, it's like, oh, really? That's what it's like on the record? Oh, I don't play it anything like that anymore. So yeah, I've been watching a lot of like dodgy iPhone videos of us playing shows this week to try and pick that up. But more importantly, I think it's definitely that kind of energy that you get from a crowd that makes every sort of performance feel like its own thing, and definitely gets rid of the sense of like just doing the same thing over and over.
So how did the arrangements change when moved from a five-piece band to a four-piece band? How did that impact you as a dynamic of the band?
Yeah, it definitely did change. Joseph like really stepped up and was able to fill dual roles, but we did change like songs like Trembling Hands are like really different in the live arrangement versus what we did on the record, or what we did when Loz was there as well, because it was a reasonably piano-led song, but we cut most of that out once we stripped down to a four-piece. Some of them just worked because they were often written as a four-piece as well before Joseph joined, so we could easily just slot back into that. There's definitely, when you have three guitarists in the band, like sometimes two of them are just playing the same sort of like big power chord sort of stuff, so having one less isn't like a massive thing. But yeah, there were certainly like some songs where we had to reimagine how we would do that. There's a song where I used to play guitar and then I stopped doing that when Joseph was there, but I went back to playing that little section in a song called Soldier On, obviously because we like use like a playback rig, so we've got elements of that we can keep an extra thing on if we need to. But since album three, when we wrote it as a four piece, then obviously, yeah, it's written more like a four piece anyway. So that kind of solved that problem, I guess.
Thank you. And we just heard from Thea, and let's say her career progression continues to ascend. Something's going to start happening that I'd like to know how you found this experience, is that strangers are going to start wanting to speak to her and say hello outside gigs, and she's going to be starting to be recognized as she goes around. And I've seen this from secondhand experience, not from me, but actually seeing close friends of this happen to. And it actually feels really surreal and slightly jarring and uncomfortable when actually you see that play out. You kind of, as a young musician growing up, oh, wouldn't that be great to be? But actually, I looked at it and thought, that's probably quite unhealthy, like for that person to be on the receiving end of. And I know you're probably quite modestly going to say, well, I'm the drummer in the background, but there, you will still get that kind of experience. What was that like? And what would you be saying to Thea about how to handle when, you know, people start recognizing? That's just a big change in your life, I think, professionally.
Yeah, that definitely is. As you were saying, like certainly as a drummer, you're like at the lesser end of the recognizable scale. So that's great. But certainly in the context of like when you're at gigs and stuff like that, and people do come up to you, for the most part, it's nice to talk to fans. And as most people like just want to say a little thing and have a little moment, and then it just moves on. And that's really easy to give someone 5 or 10 minutes of your time. It can certainly get awkward if things drag on and it gets to a certain point that it's like things aren't really running out of things to say, or people just saying the same thing over and over. I don't know. Maybe I said before General Pants hadn't helped me at all, but maybe like your entire job of selling clothes is like going up to random strangers trying to like talk to them. So maybe that did help me being on the receiving end of that. I guess when people tell you that a song that you've been a part of has had a particularly profound effect on their lives or helped them get through like a tough time, things like that, that's a beautiful compliment in itself, that you were able to create something that gave someone strength in a time of need or gave someone joy. But yeah, like I said, I think for the most part, if someone takes the time to put themselves in an awkward situation of coming up to someone in a band and wants to just tell you nice stuff, then that's it's really easy for you to give them that time and make that a sort of special moment for them. So I definitely always try and give people time for that stuff. I've been that guy like wanting to talk to some of my heroes as well. And so I definitely know how that feels. And like when you have a positive interaction with someone versus someone that just fobs you off, it's so valuable. Like I've definitely noticed that with other people, that like if you have something like a shared interest, then a conversation can happen really easily. But yeah, it is. There's only so many times you can say, "Oh, great that you love our music," sort of thing. It's a conversation that has a finite sort of end. But yeah, that's really good advice. One of the world's great Radiohead fans. I don't remember anything specifically. The one sort of a thing I remember that's in this context is I went and saw Tom York DJ in a little club in London when we lived in London. And I'd geared myself up till I was going to talk to him because he's like 4 feet away from me. But in the interim, I saw three other people go up and I could just tell that he wasn't comfortable with those interactions, which is fine. And I was like, this isn't going to be a good experience, and it's not going to be a good experience for him. It's not going to be a good experience for me. And so that was one where I was like, okay, I'm happy to not meet one of my heroes in that time because, yeah, you could just tell, like, he's a guy that, like, needs his space, and being as famous as he is, that's, like, next level fame. He's probably copping that all the time.
So one of the beauties of doing this podcast is I can ask about very specific tracks of artists I really like and just ask your opinion on or your memories of playing these particular songs. Two of them particularly, Fools and I'm Gonna Wait. Oh my word, I'm Gonna Wait. What an absolute tune that is. What are your memories of recording those songs?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm Gonna Wait. Like, we obviously like toured really intensely off the back of the first record, and then I guess in 2011, we decided to, okay, now we've got to make another record. And obviously there's all the sort of things around that of the pressure of having a reasonably successful first record. And we like got a room in a place called The Premises in London where we just set up all our gear and we just go in there every day, weeks, months. And it was like February in London and it was like just cold and grey, and being Australians, like, we just needed some sun. We're like, oh, let's go somewhere where it might be a bit hot. And we're like, we'll go to the south of Spain. We've got a house for a week and we'll just write some tunes. And so we found a place and we all went, and this little village, like maybe an hour outside Granada, and it was called Montefrio, which we found out when we got there means cold mountain. And it was really cold and wet the entire time we were there. But we set up in this amazing, like, old house, like double height sort of ceiling above the living room, and that's where we wrote I'm Gonna Wait. And there's something definitely that house the sort of space and reverb that happened to be in that room, like, really influenced the sort of like slow pace of that track and like the way that drums are played. And yeah, I remember we had the Moog, and just that sort of just resonating into this huge cavity of the house just felt like it was really fun to play. So yeah, that one, I wonder how that song, if it would have ever come about, or if it would have sounded different if we'd been in our tiny little like rehearsal writing room in London trying to write that, it might have come out really differently.
That's such a great observation. And the layered harmonies, all this, when the second chorus kicks in, I sent it to a friend yesterday and we were just gushing about these harmonies that were coming in that were just so beautiful. And that spaciousness, you're absolutely right. I wonder if that would have been the case in a smaller studio. And Falls off the first album, your drums, particularly the second half of that, are just absolutely fantastic when it really kicks in. What's your memories of recording that song?
Yeah, that one was actually a fun one to record. I was talking about earlier with Jim how much he would put us through the ringer of like doing songs over and over again to find the perfect sort of take. But that one, it was late at night, and we didn't actually, like, for all the other songs, we obviously played as a band together in doing the initial bed tracks, but that one, Jim just got me up and I just played drums along to the sort of like demo stuff that was on there. And yeah, I did two takes and he's the first one's perfect, that's fine. So that one came out really easily. And yeah, I've always loved that kind of, that particular groove is one of my favorite ones to play. Like, it's not a song we play a lot live, but when we do, yeah, I think all of us as a band are really proud of kind of the way that song worked. And it's got that sort of like interesting kind of extra couple of beats in that sort of breakdown-ish section, which is like really fun to play. I think we wrote that one, actually, Dougie, Lorenzo and I wrote that one. Johnny was off getting married. We wrote two songs while he was away, Fools and Sweet Disposition, were the kind of two ones that came out in that couple of weeks. And yeah, I think I played bass on that sort of middle section and Dougie was playing drums or something like that. And maybe that's why we leaned into doing something a bit different, because we weren't like playing our natural instruments. But yeah, I think that's one of the sort of beautiful songs that we've come up with as a band over our career.
Which gig that you've played would you choose if I gave you the opportunity to go back and watch it from the audience's perspective?
It might seem like a strange one, but there was a gig we did in a little venue called the Maroquinerie. It's in Paris. It's tiny, like a really small venue. And we played there in summer. It was like 500 people. And there was literally just like sweat coming off the roof, just like dripping everywhere. It just, there's something about like playing back in like smaller rooms where like the sort of like activation energy required for it to just become a self, sort of a kinetic thing that has its own energy that sort of moves. You no longer have sort of control of what's happening. You can get caught up in it and it can be an almost out of body experience, but it's pretty rare. Yeah. When that happens, like that's the sort of like ultimate experience, I guess, of playing live music. I don't think I've ever had it happen in the studio, because that's always got the sense of chasing something that's supposed to be perfect, whereas playing in a live sense, like it's much like looser, and you have that sort of added element of the audience, and the audience are the ones that help you transcend like what's physically happening. And so yeah, it would have been fun to be in the sort of like audience side of that and just like part of that wave, as opposed to feeling that wave come over onto the stage. That would have been a pretty fun one.
Nice. Okay, I'm quite interested also, when you sat down again after a couple of years having a bit of a break, when you had those first pre-production meetings, what were the things that you said, we're not going to do so much of this, but we're going to do more of this? What was the kind of blueprint for this particular new set of recordings?
We're at a very early like writing stage, so it was just great to get back in a room together, all four of us, because that hasn't really happened. Really, like we were writing the last record in like 2014, 15, early 2016, recording and stuff. So we haven't really done any like writing since then. So it's like a big gap. So yeah, it was more just about getting in a room together and like The most important thing was just to see if there was like still a like creative connection between the four of us, which I think that side of it went really well. We've got some sort of exciting songs that are in a very sort of genesis stage, like nothing finished, but all of us walked away from that excited to take those songs further and write some more songs. Yeah, it's just about seeing if we still have a spark together, yeah. Really.
So you do a role as well as being a drummer, but you're the musical director on occasions as well. What's the biggest thing that's gone wrong at one of your shows?
I wouldn't call myself a musical director. I'm just like the one that gets lumped with dealing with the playback rig at the same time.
The musical director.
I'll have to ask for a pay rise if that's the case.
Yeah, definitely.
So we were doing a support tour for Imagine Dragons, and I don't remember which show it was, maybe the Sydney show, but it's in a big arena. There's 15,000 people in there. And we do this big 3-minute walk-on mood piece, which we've always done things like that with all our sort of live gigs and tried to join songs and create a sort of total experience rather than just wandering out and starting to play a song or whatever. But yeah, we got to the point where the song starts with this big sort of guitar, chunky chordal riff, and like Dougie's guitar like just wasn't plugged in. And so he starts playing and there's just nothing. And yeah, I mean, I remember at the time just being like, it's super embarrassing and you have to awkwardly restart the gig and you can't really like come back. Like that sort of transcendent thing that we were talking about, like that rules that out for probably the next 2 or 3 shows because you'll just be thinking about that moment and what's gone wrong. But like any band, I don't know, we've had heaps of stuff go wrong. I remember like in our early days, like Warner sent someone else to watch us here and like part of the rig went down in the middle of the song. We had to like cut the set short and play we had 2 other songs that we could play, which we managed to do. But yeah, instead of playing like a 10 song set, we played like 6 songs and then just went off. And the more you hand over responsibility to technology in your show, you bring that upon yourself because as we all know, like all our machines, like they don't always do what you want them to do. They have a mind of their own. And yeah, that's the risk you take. And it's super awkward. Like it's the worst feeling. And yeah, I think in the Conditions anniversary thing, we got to play a lot of like our sort of early material, some of it unreleased or some of it from the first EP. And it was great. We were just 5 dudes playing music on a stage, and it's just the noise that you can make together is what the song is. And that felt actually quite freeing in that moment. Like I think we've sort of like come too far in the way we write and produce that we couldn't go back to that necessarily, but I definitely have an admiration for bands that do tread that path and can do that.
When Wynn grows up and has kids of his own and you're telling the classic stories with the grandchildren about what you did in your career, what's the one that you're going to pull out and say, this was something that we did that we were proud of, or funny story?
I think the MC, like the grand final ones, will definitely be right up there, just because being Australian, growing up in Melbourne, sort of, you know, football being such a big part of our lives. And I guess also something that, you know, Wynn will understand and his kids will understand, whereas like, you know, saying we supported Coldplay or we supported Rolling Stones, like kids might not give a fuck about that.
Yeah,
they're
that's
like,
true.
Who's that? I don't care. I'm like, they're like more, they'll be like running around in the metaverse doing their own thing. So yeah, I think that's one that will definitely stand the test of time. And while playing with the Stones was like such an amazing opportunity and experience for us, because that's a band that really means something to us and means something to our parents and things like that. Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if those other things translate down the years.
And I mean, discussing the Stones, a friend of mine did a support slot with the Stones and felt that like they weren't there. They were like still in the hotel way. It felt like it was a completely different experience and almost playing on a different festival bill. Did you have the same experience, or did you see any of the band? Did they watch you or anything like that?
I don't remember if they watched us, but we did. They were just hanging around backstage. Yeah, we managed to introduce myself to both Keith and Charlie. They were just hanging out in catering. So I did the sort of like awkward walk up and we're like, oh, hey, I'm Toby from the Temper Trap. We're supporting you. Thank you so much for giving up, having us on the bill and whatnot. And yeah, Keith sort of like, he's like, oh, And I remember this sort of like waitress walked past, kind of like a cute waitress, and he kind of like pointed her and said something else that I couldn't really understand and sort of like cackled away as well. And that was a perfect, I felt like that was a really perfect like Keith interaction. And then, yeah, we got, they do an all the band's photo, and that was the only time Mick appeared. His reputation precedes him, and it's true, I guess, that it's all just like business for him. But yeah, I remember we took the photo and Mick disappeared, but Ronnie, Keith and Charlie just hung about like they didn't know where to go next sort of thing. And we just had a bit of a chat with them and took a few photos with them on our phone. I remember their like media person saw what was happening and barged in and tried to make us like delete. Like, I think she did actually go through our manager's phone and delete a bunch of the photos because you're not allowed to take these photos. It's like only the approved photo sort of thing. But I remember Johnny managed to like keep a couple of the photos on his phone. He snuck it down his pants or whatever and pretended he didn't have it. Yeah, they were, the three of them were like really nice and super just fellas. Like, they were happy in their own skin, happy to talk to anyone. So that was cool. Charlie's a great drummer. I think he's a really underrated drummer, and he's the sort of like glue that holds that band together. Yeah, I don't know if they're going to play any more shows now, but it would be a very different dynamic. People don't sort of like necessarily rate him as an amazing drummer, but I think like he was so understated. He always served the song and never tried to show, he never made it about himself. And I think that's a really, as drummers, like you can throw in all the bells and whistles, and that there might be a moment when that's the right thing to do. But certainly I think thinking about what's the right thing to do in that moment of the song, how can you serve the song and lift up the song, is probably the best advice I could give to any up-and-coming drummer. And I think he's certainly someone that I think I learned that from listening to Stones records.
Well, listen, Toby, thank you for your advice. Thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for your guidance. So there's a lot of young musicians listening to this that can get a lot from it. Good luck with the upcoming tour with Kings of Leon. I'm delighted to hear that the creative spark is still there with the Temper Trap. And I look forward to seeing what's next on the Temper Trap and all the stuff that you're producing as well. And thank you for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me. It was great to have a chat.
This episode was mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4 month old. He's making a bit of noise in the background, giving a endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job.